the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and this is episode 151, covering the week of December 17th through December 21st, 2018. Glad to have you back on the program. Glad to be here. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Abbeville Institute, like our Facebook page at Abbeville Institute, and subscribe to our YouTube page at Abbeville Institute. You can find all those social media buttons at the top of our webpage, abbevilleinstitute.org. Give us an email address there, and we'll give you a free ebook. You'll get our daily dose of Dixie Monday through Friday and our weekly email on Saturday or Sunday, which includes a link to this podcast. Also, please download our free web application or our mobile app, either one. Just go to your favorite app store, whether it's Google Play, iTunes, and search for Abbeville Institute. You will find our mobile app there so you can get the Institute on the go. It is free of charge. Also, remember that we exist on your generous contributions alone. Here we are right at the end of 2018. If you would like to support the Abbeville Institute, if you would like to help us in our mission to explore what is true and valuable in the Southern tradition, please consider a tax-deductible donation to the full extent of the law. You can go to our webpage, abbevilleinstitute.org. Under the tab that says Support, you'll have Donor Options. Click on that, and you'll see that you can donate annually or monthly. If you want to make a one-time donation, just click on the option that says Donate What You Like. Just don't make it for the donation level, something that's already listed there. If you want to donate, say, $50, donate $50.01. Therefore, it'll allow you to do a one-time donation. But anything you would like to donate is greatly appreciated. So go to, again, abbevilleinstitute.org under Support, Donor Options, and click on that. We also have endowment and planned giving options. If you're looking to include us in your overall financial plans, you can do that as well. There's information for that. And we are wrapping up 2018. This is the last podcast for 2018. So you won't hear another podcast for the Week in Review again until we get back in January. In fact, the next episode of the podcast will be January 12th, I believe, is when we have it scheduled for the next one. So this is going to wrap up the year. We've had a great year at the Institute. We've had a lot of things to talk about. And of course, we'll be back in 2019. So I want to wrap up what we did this year. This is the point of this last week of material. We do have a couple of articles that are going to run in the last week of December and also the first week of January. One is a work of fiction. The other, which will run on Christmas Day. The other is a poem, which will run on New Year's Eve. So we do have a couple of little pieces out there for those last couple of weeks, but the last new material is going to be right here at the end of this last week, December 21st, will be the last material that we'll have for a whole week for material for the Institute. So let's talk about this week, and it's going to be a review of what we did, some things that we've accomplished this year, and looking forward into 2019 and into the future. You know, the Abbeville Institute has been around since 2002, so we're getting ready to, we're approaching our 17th year of existence. Not just that, the website in its current form has been around since 2014, so we're getting ready to approach our fifth year of that. So we've had a lot of stuff. In fact, we've had near 1,500 articles in 5 years. So that's a lot of material. We've sent out, I want to say, close to 500 or over 500 emails with our daily dose of Dixie, so and our weekly emails. So if you want to get our stuff every day in your inbox, you don't have to go to the website. Get on that email list. We've produced, including the podcast, over 400 audio files, whether they're from our conferences where we have our lectures or also this podcast. So 400 audio files. All that's free of charge on the website. All these things we do, all this stuff we do that's free. And of course, available to the public. I always laugh when people portray the Institute to be some type of organization that exists in dark corners. We do everything in secret. Everything we do is for public consumption. If you want to know what the Institute is doing, you just got to go to our webpage, our YouTube page, our SoundCloud page, wherever you want to go. All that is there. So it's not like we do anything that's hidden. Everything we do is wide open for people to see. So it's always funny to me when people remark that they make it seem like the Institute is some secret organization. We're not. And in fact, that's what the first piece speaks to this this particular week with Don Livingston. He wrote a wonderful little summary of our year, and also what some of these things that are going on mean for the future of the South and of the United States. And the title of the piece, we published it on Monday, is What Does the Fracturing of the American Identity Mean for the Southern Tradition? It begins with a review of our conferences. We had two conferences, one in February, one in November. The first was the attack on Confederate monuments and its meaning for America. The second was the revival of state nullification and secession. And so our job at the Institute is to provide context and meaning for these things, not to advocate one position or another, but to discuss what's happening here and what this means for America moving forward, what this means for the South and, and Southern culture and Southern identity. And we had a lot of great speakers, people from all over the country, all over the world spoke at these conferences. We had attendees, conference attendees from all over the country and all over the world. So they're a great time. And of course, your contributions to the Institute help keep these things going. And then, of course, we had our summer school in July, which was on the topic music and Southern identity. And again, exploring this idea of Southern culture and Southern identity in this fracturing of America. And so Dr. Livingston, who, of course, if you don't know, is the president of the Institute, gets into what this means, what this fracturing of American identity means, and trying to give some explanation to it. You know, Americans know what's happening, as you said. Americans know that it seems like the United States is coming apart. You've got multiculturalism. You've got all these different groups of people that speak different languages now, have different customs. He mentions that in some parts of Michigan, you have strong Islamic pockets. You've got strong Hispanic pockets in some parts of the United States. And in Chicago, he talks about how there's over 200 languages spoken in public schools in Chicago. So you have all this diversity. I mean, this is something that the left has been pushing now for years, diversity. And what does that mean? Well, you know, after World War II, there was a period of time, really after the war between the states, the war for Southern independence, there was a time where you had this Lincolnian America. That's the image he often uses, this Lincolnian America, where everyone seemed to be unified. There was kind of this one nation mentality. People seemed to accept it. And of course, you had reaction to it when you had the new immigration period, where you had a mass immigration in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And there was a reaction to that, and it was shut down, particularly after World War II. So for about 20 years, you had this Americanization of the United States. That was the anomaly, though. But in that period of time, people had this national identity of the United States. But you always had sectionalism, particularly before this point. You always had these regional ideas. And of course, you had the agrarians in the 1930s. They were well aware of what was happening. You had people that understood that there were still regions and sections the entire time. And then in 1993, you had George Kennan, who said, look, America's too big to function properly. We're going to have to talk about how we're going to split this thing up and how we're going to make our way in the future. We cannot have a central authority that can govern 325 million people. Our structure's not that way. Kennan was speaking in a very Jeffersonian position. And so this is what we're seeing today. We're seeing people talk about, well, we might support secession. We're seeing the Calexit phenomenon. We're talking about Texit, where people are, you know, Texas secession. We're talking about California secession, Alaska secession, Hawaiian secession, Southern secession, Vermont secession. There are secession groups all over the United States. There's also groups that are dedicated to federalism and using the states as a check on the central power. There are groups that are talking about using the 10th Amendment to justify their positions, whether it's left or right, and seeking to thumb their nose at what they consider to be unconstitutional central government. And why is this? Why is all of this happening? Because people realize there are cultural differences in America. There is a South. There is a New England. There is a West. There is a California. There's a Texas, even within the South. There are different cultures in America. We do speak the same language, for the most part. I mean, as Dr. Livingston points out, this is not always the case. We do have some of the same national heroes. But all of that is also coming apart. And he asked some questions. Whether the Union will be divided or whether it can be retained but radically decentralized, only God knows. But a number of things are clear, he says. The demographic revolution America has gone through in a single generation is something no modern nation state has ever experienced and survived. Indeed, the America that flourished from 1865 to the immigration of 1965 arguably has not survived. The conflict between red and blue states is here to stay for the foreseeable future. A recent Reuters poll found that nearly a third of Americans believe some sort of civil war will occur within 5 years, and some security analysts issued similar warnings. The genie of secession is out of the bottle and cannot be put back by reciting the Pledge of Allegiance to an indivisible nation. On a national level, social trust and patriotism has broken down. A 2017 Gallup poll found that only 44% of Americans said they were willing to fight for their country. And the central government is and has long been dysfunctional. It is incapable of reaching consensus on much-needed policies, not to mention conflicts springing from runaway spending and public debt. It has entirely lost the knowledge of how to stop growing. He says, because of all this, people are talking about all these things. All this stuff is happening. So people are saying, well, what can we do about it? How can we have an America that suits our background? And so this is what the Abbeville Institute exists for. This is one of our goals, is to talk about this Jeffersonian identity. Jeffersonianism is a response to this. Well, let's decentralize. People are talking about this. That's part of the Southern tradition. Let's look at things in a much more Jeffersonian way. Why, if America is too big, what can we do about it? Well, Jefferson provides some answers. The founding generation provides answers. We have federalism, which is an answer. And the progressives are starting to get this stuff. I mean, we've written pieces on this over the year, progressive neo-Confederates. They understand that the states really are the bastions of government in America. They're the fountain of government in America. They understand this. But most Americans focus too much energy on the central authority. Now, if you like what we do, he asked for a call. Please donate. Pay by check. Go online. Support what we do here. Support this website. All this stuff costs money. Support the podcast. Support the things that we do. None of this stuff is free. And so we want you to help us in our mission. We want you to stand in the breach with us. That's what I say in the piece that I wrote for Friday. Same thing. And the piece on Tuesday, it's a book review by Paul Gottfried on a wonderful new book, The Land We Love by Boyd Cathy. And Boyd, of course, writes for us. He has been involved in defending the South and exploring the Southern tradition for a long time. And Gottfried actually asks a question here. When you look at what's happened over the last couple of years, where are Southerners when these monuments are being torn down? Where are they? They're sitting on their hands, or they're even complicit in the process. This would have been unheard of just a generation ago. And of course, this is a collection of essays, some of which have appeared on the Abbeville Institute. And it's a look at what it means to be Southern. As he says, anyone who surveys the titles of Boyd's essays, A New Reconstruction, How Neoconservatives Destroyed the Southern Conservatism, How You Stand on the War Between the States, A Window into Your View of the Western Christian Heritage, Merchants of Hate, Morris Deeds, and Southern Poverty Law Center, he knows that Boyd's come to fight. And as Paul points out, there was a time when Southern conservatives were really listened to in modern conservatism, but not so much anymore. The neoconservatives have taken over. But his heroes in this book are people like Mel Bradford, Nathaniel Macon, Robert E. Lee, Jefferson Davis. It's a wonderful book, a wonderful collection of essays. I always enjoy reading Boyd's work, and you can get them now in this particular book. We do have the link to it on the website where you can purchase the book through Amazon. He also, though, you know, what people don't understand about Dr. Kathy is that he was trained in European history. And so he loves Spain. And he talks about the similarities between Spanish aristocrats and also Virginian or Southern conservatives. And so this is an interesting part of the book. It's something that also Clyde Wilson did when he wrote his book on Pettigrew and talked about how much Pettigrew loved Spain. Washington Irving loved Spain. Washington Irving, of course, from New York, but an important 19th century American literary figure who did not like Yankees, who did not like New England. He loved the South. His estate, Sunnyside, was essentially a Southern estate in New York. It's a wonderful, he's a wonderful writer. So you have this nice collection of essays in defense of the South. And you wonder, I mean, this is, again, why we exist. We want people to be engaged in this and to talk about these things intelligently, not just be a reactionary, but intelligent discussion about why the South matters, why the Southern tradition matters, and what that critique of America can mean for the 21st century. There are positive things to say about the South. There are positive things the South can offer in 21st century America. And that's what we try to express on a weekly basis through our written work, through this podcast, through our conferences when we have those. The South offers a rose. The Southern tradition is a rose that should be cultivated and watered, fed, because that rose is a beautiful part of what makes America what it is. And for a long time, it dominated America. And let me get into my piece that I wrote on Friday, What Are Symbols For? Every tradition has its thorns. Every tradition has its negatives. And the Southern tradition is no different. But every tradition also has beautiful things. And it's, I mean, look, the South is not the only tradition in America. There are others. But the Jeffersonian tradition allows for these differences to exist and coexist. I mean, Jefferson is the author of the Virginia Statute on Religious Freedom. I mean, that's Jefferson. Federalism allows for different cultures and different regions to flourish and not have one dominate the other. It allows for those things. And perhaps even the states that we have today are too large. When the United States was founded, and you have the first census in 1790, there were 4 million people. There's 4 million people today in the state of Alabama. Is Alabama too large to function properly? Does it really need more of a federal government in the center of the state and allow the cities and others, the localities, to allow their cultures to flourish? What about California? These are important questions. Is California too big? Is Texas too big? I mean, people may not think so. People may think so. But these are important questions. This is where the Jeffersonian tradition can provide maybe some answers to these things. But the question I ask in this particular piece, and then we'll get to the last couple of pieces for the week, is what are symbols for? And I begin with a story. In 1875, you had the dedication of the Stonewall Jackson Monument in Richmond, Virginia. A monument which is under attack, as all monuments are. Confederate monuments are across the United States. But when this monument was unveiled in 1875, 40,000 people attended the ceremony. That was probably the entire population of the city. 40,000 people. You can't get 40 people to attend a monument dedication today, or 40 people to even rally around a monument, a Southern monument today. Now, why is that? A lot of that has to do with the way people perceive these things, and that has to do with our education system and what we've been taught, what people have been taught in America. These monuments represent something that doesn't matter, and I think it's also a cynicism that Americans have. These things just aren't important. But these monuments meant something to the people that put them there. And no, it's not white supremacy and racism, as the left would like you to think. Not that at all. In fact, the address given by a Reverend Moses Drury Hodge said what this monument meant. And I'm going to read you parts of this because it's so important. He believed that in the future, people from all over the world would travel to these monuments and realize what they were. Not just from the South, but all over the world would come to them because they were an expression of Western civilization, of heroism, patriotism, duty. They fully embodied the great traits of Western civilization. This is what these monuments meant, whether it was here in Richmond, or whether it was other parts of the South, whether ultimately Stone Mountain. This is what these monuments meant. They embodied the heroic tradition of Western civilization, of resistance to tyranny. And he says the people that attended these monuments will be accompanied by honor and freedom. These are the principles by which Jackson lived and died. And the people that went there would celebrate honor and freedom. But then he makes a point. He says, okay, I'm willing, we're all Southerners are willing to put down the sword. We're willing to be accepted into this American nation again, this national government. We'll accept it. But he does say, he urged the thousands, the 40,000 people there, not to shut their eyes at the fact of what had happened in America. He says, he reminded people not to shut our eyes to the fact that this consolidated empire of states is not the union established by our fathers. No intelligent European student of American institutions is deceived by any such assumption. We gain nothing by deceiving ourselves. He looked around and he said, you know what we've got in 1875? It's not the union of the founders. We're willing to accept what it is and put down our sword, because we have these monuments standing behind him. He says, we have these things. And he said, and now standing before this statue, and as in the living presence of the man it represents, cordially endorsing, as I do, the principles of the political school in which he was trained and in defense of which he died, I speak not for myself but for the South when I say it is our interest, our duty and determination to maintain the Union and to make every possible contribution to its prosperity and glory, if all the states compose it, will unite in making it such a union as our fathers framed, and in enthroning it above it, not a Caesar, but the Constitution in its old supremacy. We're all willing to support it, but if you support the old Union. So in other words, Jackson was defiance. Jackson was America. Jackson embodied the original America. And he said that America can only be maintained if the state stood, quote, on the same level with such a jealous regard for each other's rights that when the interest or honor of one is assailed, all of the rest, feeling the wound, even as the body feels the pain inflicted on one of its members, will kindle with just resentment at the outrage, because an injury done to a part is not only a wrong, but an indignity offered to the whole. But then he offered, if that could not happen, if these states could not maintain their equality, then I trust the day will never dawn when the Southern people will add degradation to defeat and hypocrisy to subjugation, by professing a love for the Union which denies to one of their states a single right accorded to Massachusetts or New York. To such a Union we will never be heartily loyal while that bronzed hand grasps its sword, while yonder river chants the requiem of the 16,000 Confederate dead who, with Stuart among them, sleep on the hills of Hollywood. In other words, He did not think that people needed, Southerners needed to be degraded into supporting a union that degraded them. This is a question that we have today. Why do we support things that degrade us? So these statues, these symbols, Southern symbols, Confederate symbols, represent Hodge's spirit and the spirit that animated countless patriots from Runnymede to Appomattox. This is why the left wants to tear them down. It's not about white supremacy and oppression. No, it's about tradition. They know what it means. They know those symbols are defiant, that they are in their face, saying, we don't want your centralization. This is not our union. The basket of deplorables must be marginalized, deplatformed, silenced, and politically eliminated. And then every now and then they say these things. They openly say it. For example, history professor Megan Kate Nelson at Brown University said as much. She wants to take a hammer and knock these things down and leave the rubble there and then put a plaque up. Here is the old Western tradition. We just tore it down. It's gone. It's gone. And it seems like the people that advocate these positions are the majority in American society. And as a result, these attacks are going to continue. So we have to make a choice. Do we want to support the America of Washington, Jefferson, Henry, Madison, Lee, Monroe, Davis, Jackson, the Magna Carta, Jeffersonian spirit of self-determination and federalism? Or do we want to support Professor Nelson? What the Institute supports is the other side, the real American tradition. So if you support that tradition, please support us. Please stand in the breach with us. And an embodiment of that, of course, December 20th is Secession Day in South Carolina. And Karen Stokes sent a little piece over that had a play-by-play, so to speak, of what happened there at the Secession Convention and how the people of South Carolina reacted to this. It's something that you wouldn't see today. And he says, when the reporter who was reporting this said that when President Jameson said, I do therefore declare South Carolina to be a separate independent commonwealth, every man, woman, and child leapt up, hats flew high in the air, and cheer after cheer echoed and re-echoed from floor to roof, from side to side, until exhausted it fell down in one long, loud cadence of rejoicing. It was the noblest moment of my life. Even now, while I write, my blood thrills with excitement at the thought. The same scene was reenacted in the street when South Carolina declared its independence in December 1860. That was the spirit of Jeffersonianism. I mean, we can say that, you know, did this happen, and was it reckless? I mean, we can look back and think of all these things, but at the same time, that's Jeffersonian America. That's an independent people fully expressing their independence, something that Southerners don't often do anymore. And for the last piece to talk about this week, it's the Neo-Puritan War on Christmas, written by John Devaney, and how it's a funny little piece describing the difference between Northern and Southern Christmas. And how Puritans really didn't like Christmas. They didn't. Puritans didn't want you to have any fun at Christmas, and that's because Puritans don't ever want you to have fun doing anything. And how the South was different. The South really enjoyed Christmas because there was no Puritanism in the South until a little later on. And Dr. Devaney calls it the Neo-Puritan impulse to ensure that nobody has any fun. You know, you can't sing Baby It's Cold Outside anymore. But you can have Miss Cardi B on there crooning about various and sundry parts of the female anatomy on a family holiday television show. And of course, the Neo-Puritans, he says, view themselves as the great social and cultural sanitizer. Sanitizers. You can't say Merry Christmas. You can't have the Holy Family now saying decreed the term White Christmas is racist. I mean, all these things are the Neo-Puritans. They're not doing it because of religion. They're doing it because of a civic religion. He says, why do the Neo-Puritans hate Christmas? They hate Christmas for many of the same reasons that they hate the South. At its essence, Christmas is a celebration of humanity's need for a savior. and God's generous response to sending His only Son to share our nature and redeem us through His sacrifice on the cross. Thus the term Christmas, the Mass of Christ. Then he goes on, Southerners in general have always possessed a clear understanding of this reality, meaning that what Christmas actually is. The Southerner did not go about seeking to build utopias, nor did he one day worship God, the next day mammon, and the next day transgenderism. Like Adam of old, the traditional Southerner understood boundaries, limits, the important labor of ameliorating evil and man's helplessness in opposing evil without the grace of God. So the traditional Southern Christmas is much more than a happy holiday. It is a joyous celebration that despite our sins and limitations, God so loved us He sent His only Son. This joy is present in the masses and services of the Holy Feast. The superabundance of this divine joy spills over into Christmas, morning hunts, family reunions, gift-giving, stuffed hams and sweet potato casserole, and the singing of carols. It is neither a white Christmas nor a winter holiday. It is what the great Southern South Carolina author William Gilmore Sims described as a golden Christmas. A merry Christmas of hope and joy found under blue skies, soft southern breezes, and a warm sun. And as such, it stands as a powerful rebuke to all dour, gloomy, and self-righteous Puritans, past and present. I love that, because that's what it is. And on that note, I do wish everyone listening to this podcast a very Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. We will be back in 2019. We have some great things planned. One particular initiative that I think is going to hopefully transform Southern education for the masses, the way we think about these things. And then I hope you would get involved in that when we do it, because I think it can do a lot to change the way people think about the South and the Southern tradition and American heroes in general. So I hope you support that initiative. We will be back January 12th with the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Until next year, good day.